only in the intellectual property context, but also in the context of broadcasting, has been thinking about the ways in which technologies affect the enclosure of public spaces. And it's a slightly different technological question, but I think fundamentally the same values question. Yochai from NYU will present his cut on it. Jim Fishkin's a completely different bird. First of all, he's not a lawyer, to his credit, so many of you would say. Jim's from the University of Texas and has been leading his own extraordinarily inspirational campaign that has infected me and many around the Berkman Center for getting people to think about deliberative democracy. That if we look around and we think democracy is failing, one reason democracy is failing is the lack of any reflective or useful input from the people. Jim has been building models and examples of making this work. And our hope was he would integrate a little bit of that into this discussion of how we might get the same kind of reflective input on the type of questions we've been talking about today. And then Danny is the weirdest of the birds that we have, who's mixed policy and dabbles in law and technology and really provides, I think, the most, the broadest number of perspectives, was in Washington fighting the good fight with CDT, but now is not but now, but and is also now fighting the good fight at W3 with work on metadata and patent problems. All four are going to answer this question of what do we do to get people to see how this is a problem and how we approach it, and what ideas do we carry out from that. Now, I'm going to give them, this is like a quiz show, I'm going to give them 4.5 minutes to think about that, because I want Eric to talk about, for 4.5 minutes, an actual example of a case where we're attempting to get people to see the values in the commons. Eric Eldred is the, what do you call yourself, the publisher of Eldridge Press. Why don't you take a couple minutes while these guys work and tell us a little bit about the case.
Can you hear me now? Okay. Basically, I started in 1995 to try to use the World Wide Web as a way of publishing books electronically, just as a sort of a hobby. I had worked in some computer companies before doing this professionally, and it seemed to me that the World Wide Web had some possibilities for doing it in ways that would not been exploited through electronics books like Project Gutenberg. Does anybody know that? Or MIT's Shakespeare project to begin with is just text files basically without any hyperlinks and so on. So I wanted to try to experiment with it. And it sort of became a full-time hobby and a big project from them, where I actually signed on to take care of a number of authors like Nathaniel Hawthorne and Oliver Wendell Holmes and so on. And not that I'm an expert in them at all. I'm just a sort of computer hacker with some average computer hardware and software at home. I use a Linux machine, I have a cable modem, and I use the new software to VI and that sort of thing to do my HTML coding. And it's pretty much what anybody could actually do if they had some experience in doing it. What I'm saying is that I didn't wait for Harvard or anyone else to fund me to do it. I just started it. And I found that it was the capital to do it is infinitesimal. It's nothing. The ability to do it, I can scan a book while watching television or even reading another book. I mean, there's really hardly anything to it. It's mechanical operation. Even a Supreme Court justice, I've said, could learn to do it in 15 minutes. But my part was in presenting it as best I could, not only proof of it, but also by being able to put in links, notes, explanatory material, link to other things on the web, and make it into a sort of a living document that other people could interact with. I actually started an essay contest, did some online learning experiments with email, had some discussion groups about literature and so on. All these things attracted a lot of interest in other people then, you know, also began doing this. I wasn't the only one who was doing it. I found that there was probably 100 or 200 people around the world who were all engaged in scanning books and making basically what's a public library online. And I thought we had good prospects to do that until last October when the Congress suddenly passed the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, which basically put off limits most of the stuff that was published after 1922 in this country. So I was upset about it, shut down my site, told people to write the president to veto it. He did that. I don't know exactly how people like Larry heard about my case. Maybe you could comment. I don't know. Did you read in the New York Times or something? Yeah. So it got a little attention, and even though 50 law school professors had written a letter to Congress saying that this was bad policy, that was ignored. So and that's the first of it. But I want to say that it's really, you know, it's not open source or whatever that's important. It's the fact that all the content now that will be available on the internet in the future has a very strong chance of being controlled by just a few people. Instead of the internet's potential for, like me with a cable modem and high bandwidth, having a server at home, there's no legal basis for my doing that. All right, it's only at the pleasure of the powers that be that can interrupt this at any time. It's illegal for me as a criminal act to violate any or infringe anyone else's copyright because of the Med Act, MIT student, you know, who put something online even though I'm not selling it. Also, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act makes it into a criminal offense to remove somebody's copyright notice from something. What we're faced with is a media giants that wants to turn the internet into pay TV. And people like me, who represent sort of the older generation of the internet, are trying to resist that by showing people that they can participate in a political democracy and produce works on their own. And other people can then discuss this sort of thing, and we can reach conclusions together instead of having all our intellectual property locked up in some boardroom in Hollywood or in New York City. There are many other, copyright term extension is only the first of these things. There's also, you know, the Section 2B to the Universal Uniform Commercial Code, I think, which puts a shrink wrap license onto things and so on. I found that my effort to keep things open was kind of not exactly the same, not congruent with the open source or open code or open software movement. It seems that the putting things into the public domain is not considered to be advisable by the free software people. They feel that it's better to copyright it and then put a license onto the software so that in the future it will be kept open. Now, I think this is a matter of kind of discussion. It's something that needs to be explored, how it's possible to generalize from the case of open software that we started with to open content in the case of books or media or music or other things. I mean, the whole idea of digital media is beyond that of software now, and it's not exactly on the same plane. For instance, it's possible to copyright a piece of software without having to actually deposit the source code of the software in the Library of Congress. Now, this seems to be a shame because it means that when the copyright term expires and the software theoretically returns to the public domain, it's quite likely that there won't be any equipment that would actually be able to run the binary code. It seems to me that there should be a requirement to have the source code available, full amount of source code in deposit. Also, when you take, for instance, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, it's extending copyright to something that is unbelievably complex. When you have a case that might potentially violate the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, it really hinges on the fact of whether or not this is copyrightable or whether it's copyrighted. in order to determine that, you'd actually have to look at the source code in order to determine whether you copied the source code. If without having that on deposit, you can't tell whether you're violating it. So there are many issues, concrete issues, involved in this. Now, in order to determine now whether a work that was first published after 1922 is actually in copyright or was not renewed in time after 28 years, it's necessary to look at some big red books called the Catalog of Copyright Entries that are published twice a year by the Government Printing Office through the Library of Congress Copyright Office. These books are not that easy to find. There were none in New Hampshire where I live, and so I had to go to the Boston Public Library to look at them. Last year, I believe they had a flood in the basement, which destroyed quite a lot of their government documents, including some of their catalog of copyright entries. So I was kind of sunk. It should be online so that you can determine whether or not these registrations were properly renewed. The government has not seen fit to put online registrations between 1950 and 1977, so that it's very difficult to determine whether or not these are actually under copyright. The second thing is, if you did find that it was under copyright, you might want to write the copyright owner and determine whether or not it would be possible to use it to publish it online. Many people would be happy. You know, the fact is, it turns out that it's extremely difficult to find out who owns these copyrights. People are dead. Their heirs may have inherited. They don't know about it. The book has been long out of print. The publishers are no longer in business. And it's a real nightmare. So what I'm saying is that this whole patent and copyright system is designed very often to thwart the accessibility of people like me who want to make it available to everyone in the world. And I don't think the way things are going that the forces are strong enough to represent the public and make it possible to have something like a global public library. If we rely on the institutions like large libraries like Library of Congress or the government or universities or foundations and so on, it's not going to happen. I could take a case like the Martin Luther King Foundation, for instance. His estate owns, you know, copyright to all his writings. And now there's a case saying that one of his speeches that he gave, you know, before a large crowd was actually copyrighted. Well, all of his papers have actually been contributed, donated to, I believe it's the University of California, Berkeley. First they were at BU, but they disagreed with the impression that some of the curators gave of the quality of his PhD thesis. But anyway, they're really locked up. They're not being available. They could be easily available on the web, but it's not possible to do that. So, you know, what we want to do is try to make these things accessible and to remove the barriers that big publishers and so on are putting in the way.
Great. Okay, so I have a lot of rhetoric, a way of getting people to see this. And Jamie, I said I'd call on you last. Why don't you go first?
Okay. There are so many things to say about this that it just wouldn't even be possible to fit it into the time, so I'm going to do a set of snippets, and I'm not even going to try and pretend that they're linked together. The first is that, let's start with a philosophical point. Computers and the net bring patent into an inexorable crash as two sides of patent hit each other and implode. The first side of patent is that you can't patent ideas, you can't patent natural laws, you can't patent an algorithm, theoretically. But of course, as soon as you put that into a computer, the computer becomes, according to the recent patent case law, not a general purpose Turing machine, but a special purpose Turing machine, and that machine can be patented. So that these computers here are many computers. Each of these is 5, 6, 7, depending on how many programs are running on it. Each of those is a separate computer, the way that the patent law looks at it. And those computers working through their algorithms, that's what can be patented, not the idea, the algorithm itself. So it, the idea of the Turing machine allows patent law to extend to the very areas it was forbidden to extend to, ideas, algorithms, processes, natural laws. Thus, patent becomes imperial. It takes over far more than we would have imagined. At the same moment, the things that computers allow, particularly communications networks, introduce us in the most obvious way to the reality of network effects. And network effects, among other things, make an economy built on patenting and individual intellectual property rights not feasible. It means it doesn't work. Now, large companies realize this. Many of them engage in patent pools, creating for themselves a little privatized public domain in which they can basically get rid of the intellectual property rights and allow them to exchange. But of course, not everybody can play in those. This project, then, the open source, open code movement, is located at the hinge of the two sides of patent. It is in the computer, in the general purpose slash special purpose Turing machine, that patent policy finds itself at war with itself. This represents the light side rather than the dark side of that conflict. Second, I've got a whole set of things here. The development of a rhetoric, a litigation strategy, a lobbying strategy, a transactional clinic, technical innovation. Let me see if I can pick a couple of things out of this. In terms of a rhetoric, we need rhetorics which are developed at every level. On the most general level, it seems to me that the public domain, the idea of open source, open content, needs a way of explaining to people why they should care about the public domain. And the analogy, which is Larry suggested I use, is to the environment. And in particular, I think we all need to go back and study the invention of the environment in the 1940s and 50s. The environment, after all, being an idea that didn't exist. There were lakes, there were trees, but where was the environment? How on earth could you have got a duck hunter to believe that he or she had something in common with a bird watcher, that he or she had something in common with somebody who liked to eat seafood? Nowadays, we all understand wetlands. Sure, you need to preserve wetlands to have any of those things. But, you know, where is this perception of common interest comes? It comes from the creation of a concept, and the concept is the concept of the environment. We need to create the public domain before we can defend it, right? Second thing. I disagree with some of the comments about the impossibility of affecting public policy. I think that's a real mistake. In particular, right now, there are government departments which have budgets and institutional philosophies which are precisely attuned to the philosophy of the public domain. Some obvious examples, the Justice Department. Justice Department already, on copyright, a lot of things, looks at intellectual property rights and sees monopoly. This is something that can be exploited. The science establishment within the federal government. There are just lots and lots of places where it is simply not a given. We don't need to say, oh, this is going to happen inexorably. Rather, we can exploit the fissures within government departments. In terms of, then there's a sort of really crude thing. We need a set of factoids and connections to people's lives. Factoids, for example, bad patents. Joseph Riegel and I were talking about just creating a page which would explain to people how bad patents are. And the point is you can't use the software patents because nobody realizes how ridiculous it is that multitasking could be patented or that, you know, close a window and open a new screen could be patented. You need patents like the one that I mentioned before, which is a patent for calculating the tip on a restaurant check, which consists of two columns, one with the amount of the restaurant cost, the meal, the other with 10%, 15%, 20%, and so forth. And the column going down. That was patented 3 weeks ago. Now that's a patent people can understand. It's stupid, right? It's just really stupid. We need a lot of stupid patents. And the idea here is, I mean, taxpayer assets. You know, this is going back to the public trust argument. Taxpayer assets are being handed over. And again, I want to stress, contrary to what a lot of people may have suggested, the constitutional side of intellectual property law is, I think, extremely hospitable to this. Courts have, both in patent and copyright, said repeatedly, you have to be an author in order, you have to be an original author in order to get a copyright. Where does that come from? I didn't see that in the copyright clause. Originality has been written into the copyright clause. The ideas of non-obviousness and novelty have been interpolated into the copyright clause. You can say they're there, so a lot of the things which we're arguing for are no less an extension Just finishing up. Two things that seem particularly important. The first is a transactional clinic. It seems to me that the Berkman Center, and indeed they've already started doing this by putting licenses available online, is just admirably well suited to greasing the wheels of private action. I go back to something that Mr. Eldred said. You shouldn't rely on something that's being done by the government. Rather, we should facilitate lots of people who want to do things in a way which uses open code. But that may mean thinking what they would need and making that stuff available, which is also a wonderful experience and the kind of thing that law students should certainly learn. Finally, technical innovations. I do believe that we don't need to choose between Richard's position, which I agree with, which is we need to fundamentally challenge and rethink the premises of intellectual property, and on the other hand, the idea that we can work right now with the system we have rather than sort of throwing up our hands and that we can attack it. There are lots of different ways, but it seems to me here are two. First, I thoroughly support the idea of the prior art databases, both the lobby in Congress in order to fund the PTO to create a better prior art database. Second, the creation of a decentralized prior art database which could aggregate the knowledge which is so available on the net. Second, there are lots of other kinds of projects which could use open code in the support of open code values. I'm a great believer in exemplifying your method in the product. One example which I'd like to mention is that Ernie Miller from the Yale Law School is trying to work on a program which would allow law, primary legal text, to be available on the net and to be searchable in just the way that the fancy Westlaw and Lexis are, by coding them with VRML so that someone could have this distributed database of primary legal text. That's an example of something which both in its method and in its actual result and values exemplifies the approach that people are putting forward there. It seems to me if we aggregate all of those, then we have the beginnings of a rhetoric that spans both theory and action.
Okay, but wait. I've got a question for you. So tell me, you've been thinking about how to characterize the environmental movement here for a long time. And the thing that gets that kind of esteem is connection to the person who's fishing and the person who wants to watch. How do you get people to see the environmental elements in this intellectual property or this commons? In particular, how do you get, so we started with this example this morning, Barney Frank not to see it as stealing, right? And somebody takes data from a
It has to be a multi-front offensive. The first thing that you do is connect it to things that people already understand as public spaces. So you connect it, for example, to schools. You say you want to put the internet in everyone's classroom. Then what would it mean if the Intermind patent is recognized? How much is this going to add in terms of cost? So that you sort of, that's the consequential side. You show people the public values they already hold about the socialization and inculcation of public values in spaces they already understand as public are threatened by this. The second thing that you do is you take the examples of intellectual property where intellectual property is so obviously cutting off access to something that people see in another box. So you say, can someone own a word so I could forbid you to use the word Olympic? You know, so you take the answer yes. You know, you take situations like that where the free speech challenge is obvious. You take the ownership of the genome. You say, you mean someone could own genetic code, right? You take all of those examples, and by taking those examples, you get people to work back to their understanding of what the core is. So then there's a larger sort of there's sort of two philosophical points which need to be iterated and worked out in practical examples. The first is the idea of externalities. We understand that the factory which isn't forced to pay for pollution will continue to pollute and won't price its products accordingly. We need to think of intellectual property rights as a form of pollution. Pollution, after all, only happens when people are doing things, you know, for a good reason. Presumably they want to make widgets, but there's a cost. We need to factor in the cost to the public domain of every intellectual property right grant. The second idea which the environmental used was the notion of ecology. We need to have our stories, this unexpected reciprocal connections among systems which cause disastrous results from well-intentioned interventions. We need to show the unexpected reciprocal disastrous effects of intellectual property right grants. And the internet seems to me the single best place to do that.
Well, I think the fact that we're calling this the open code working day means that open code has in some sense become a rhetorical vehicle to talk about a much deeper, wider problem in society. And that is that we have come to think of all information as controlled. We have come to think of the fact that all information is controlled as a good thing, as something that is just, right, works well, because we might call it moral rights, because mostly we call it efficient. What open code does is set up in the middle of what we all understand as our economic engine, software production, an instance of human productivity that is fundamentally opposed to our generally perceived unthinking conception of how human productivity happens. And what we need to do is expand the notion that that being a productive human being requires that resources be controlled by individuals and mostly by organizations that employ individuals and pay individuals. So I think to some extent that the most tremendously important effect of the role of open code in the software industry is actually that rhetorical vehicle. What we have with the convergence of two things, the development of the digital network environment and the centrality of the information economy to the US economy, at least when we're talking about the national debate, is this opportunity to make a point about the lack of necessity of property, of individual control, of organizational control, the possibility of a commons, the possibility of living as productive, speaking human beings in a public sphere and in a public domain. There are at least four dimensions of resistance to this understanding. The first is theoretical. At the level of elite thinking, both economic and political morality, we don't have very strong theories of the commons, and we need to develop them. Information is a particularly good domain in which to do the economic theory debate, because within traditional mainstream economics, it's a particularly quirky resource. So we need to work out the economics of information production to show why it is that exclusive control over products and exclusive control over resources is not only unnecessary, it is bad, it is inefficient. And at the level of political theory and political morality, we need to explain why it is that property constrains autonomy. Why it is that property and information controls constrains not only personal autonomy, but political self-governance as well. And here again, stories are a good thing. When Disney cuts off a story that criticizes security in Disney World, that's an easy story to understand how property and ownership over both the content and the means for its carriage constrained public discourse. Those are stories that need to be told to develop a political morality that resists the propertization of our information environment. The second level is institutional. Because our theories have led us to think that individual and organizational control over resources, and in particular information resources and products, is efficient and just, we have developed a whole series of institutions and almost like a slapstick, with increasing speed, we propertize more and more of our information environment. And here there needs to be resistance both at the congressional level, and increasingly this becomes old news, at an elite discourse level, that elite being the judicial elite, the elite that doesn't have to go for that doesn't have to go to the information industries for political donations. And that's where political morality gets translated into First Amendment and the particular force of the First Amendment and developing that portion of the First Amendment that focuses on open access and on decentralization of information production and access to information. So that's the institutional level, and again, at every layer. The third layer is organizational. You have universities that understand themselves as being like businesses and trying to professionalize themselves in the sense of becoming more like businesses. There becomes an increasing conception that organizations have been structured along a conception that relies on the notion that information must be propertized in order to produce information efficiently. Therefore, we build organizations around the institutions that serve that theoretical conception, and organizations develop to take advantage of that. And the classic example is the shifting and the permission for universities to patent the products of research funded by the government. Now, here you have a theoretical conception that property in information is a good thing, implemented through an institutional arrangement that permits stuff that if it would have been directly produced by government-paid scientists would not have been patentable, would have been in the public domain, instead gets patentable. And you create universities, you make universities get into the business of extracting commercial value from information production, which is a completely different organizational role for them. So again, the debate needs to be within organizations about understanding their role as freeing up information resources, and then internal debates about organizational frameworks and internal institutional values, such that, for example, publishing in a peer-reviewed journal that is online and therefore doesn't need the economies that sustain Elsevier becomes possible. We have internal institutional organizational mechanisms that prevent that. And finally is cultural, and that's much harder to reach. That's not something that needs to be done at the elite level. That's something that needs to be done at a much broader level, and that's the notion of, it's mine, I made it, and explaining why it is that information isn't quite mine, that information is about relationships and long-term relationships and conversations, and not something that you could plausibly think of as I own my statement in this conversation as though it were a one-sided set of monologues. And these four dimensions need to be worked on at their relative levels, some at the level of institutional organizational elites, some at the level of mass cultural conversation, in order to crystallize this shift from a conception of a controlled way of being a productive human being to an open and relational way of being a productive human being.
Okay, so Jim, can you take that objective and institutionalize it, or tell us how we can get people, especially the last part, to understand culturally the significance of these values?
Let me step back and set a context for what I want to say. I'm concerned with democracy and what kind of public dialogue, what kind of public participation will fill the commons, even if your commons can be protected from the enclosure movements that you described earlier. And the internet is especially important let's consider two kinds of democracy. One I'll call pseudo-democracy, and the other I'll call deliberative democracy.
Which are you in favor of?
we'll take a poll at the end, right? Now, the thing is that the internet is easily used for pseudo-democracy. Oh, and I want to describe two contexts. One is politics generally, and the other is the governance of the internet. And the prospect of pseudo-democracy is overwhelmingly likely in both contexts. And the possibility of deliberative democracy to fill the public space is only possible with a great deal of work and effort and institutional innovation, which I'll briefly describe just as a possibility. Now, example, what do I mean by pseudo-democracy? Well, there was things that purport to mechanisms and events and expressions that purport to speak for the people that don't. A colleague of mine named Norman Bradburn at the University of Chicago, who I've collaborated with on several of the projects I'll describe, coined the term SLOP, self-selected listener opinion poll. And the internet has now brought to life the SLOP, which radio stations were doing before. You know, call in if you believe, well, instead on the internet, all kinds of media organizations have SLOPs. And slops, now the slops about presidential candidates are just starting and in the primary season. And they purport to represent the public, but what they actually represent is something that instead of grassroots, political operatives say what they're representing is something more synthetic, namely AstroTurf. What it is it's an organized effort. You know, if you get thousands of people who are orchestrated to vote for George W. or Albert Gore or whoever it is. The worst slop of all, I can't resist mentioning my story, which is the Time magazine had a slop about the man of the century. They had an internet poll about the man of the century. Who was the greatest statesman, the greatest thinker, the greatest, the greatest statesman, the greatest thinker, the greatest warrior, the greatest entertainer, and the best dresser. And for some reason, they got millions of votes. For some reason, one person won in all five categories. And it turned out to be Mustafa Kemal Atatürk was the best in all categories because the Turkish people organized and voted around the clock. School children, millions. And he beat, by one press report I had, is he beat Winston Churchill by 2.5 million votes. And the Greeks were organizing to vote for Winston Churchill in at least some of the categories to stop. Yeah, all right. Anyway, the point is that they thought it was real democracy to let anybody just vote and call in or, in fact, vote on the internet, and it turned out to be pseudo-democracy. And the other problem with democracy, and there are two problems with public opinion. By the way, I just realized that a word connects is what got me all into this, because I've been concerned with public opinion. We've been concerned here with public spaces. The whole point about both is you need a public for both. And the problem with mass society today is we very often don't have a public. We don't have a shared dialogue and a sharing of concerns and a sharing of information. We have privatistic, isolated activities, and we need to create the conditions for a public to fill the public space. Now, I came up with a way of doing this in prototype. I call it deliberative polling. We take a random sample of the public, give them a questionnaire of the ordinary sort, then we invite them to come, it's been done face-to-face, we invite them to come to a single place where over 2, 3, 4 days they have a shared dialogue under the best conditions you can reasonably imagine for them to form a considered judgment. Balanced briefing materials, access to competing experts, dialogue with each other, people talking to other people from completely different social locations. We did this on PBS in January 1996. Jim Lehrer hosted it. It was called the National Issues Convention. We brought people from all over the United States. Now, we had tremendous problems. There was a woman who had, National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago recruited the sample. There was a woman on a farm in Alabama who, you know, she couldn't come because there was nobody to milk her cow. We sent out a researcher to milk her cow, and we brought her to Austin, Texas, and we got a very good national random sample of the whole country in a single place, and they came to very different views about the issues of the campaign after compared to before. We've done this 4 times in Britain with a television network, Channel 4. We're about to do this in Australia before the referendum on that they're going to have on becoming a republic in October. Now, the thing about deliberative polling, it works. Indeed, we've also had local ones that are a lot cheaper because they're local, but it works, but it's expensive because, I mean, in the National Issues Convention, we had to have an official airline, American Airlines, I don't mind thanking them, brought people from all over the United States, Alaska, all the way to Austin, Texas, where the thing was held. Online, we wouldn't have that expense. But could we create real deliberation? There's a book coming out about the National Issues Convention called A Poll with a Human Face. Could we give it a human face? Could we really create a context where people could deliberate, and you'd get people for in small groups with trained moderators. With, well, I think we could, and we have a project. Larry, Andrew McLaughlin back there, and I have a project here at the Berkman Center, which proposes to do this online, and we found a way to provide computers to a national random sample of the country in a cost-effective way, and we're going to link them in a continuing dialogue if we raise enough of the money, but much less money than I had to raise the last time. And we've got a couple of different contexts. One context is with the Foreign Policy Association in the context of foreign policy issues in the presidential campaign. But the other context is for, at least in prototype form, the governance of the Internet itself, because the Internet, as you know, is going to be covered by ICANN. And ICANN is going to have a board of 18 people, 9 of whom are selected by technical supporting organizations, and 9 of whom are to be selected in some way by the relevant public, whatever that is. One model for that is that has been a subject of a great deal of public discussion is anybody in the world can join ICANN and then those people vote. I think it's going to be, as a political scientist, I think it's going to be AstroTurf. I think it's going to be captured. And I think that's going to be a form of pseudo-democracy. So I have proposed, and this is public because this is on the web, I have proposed a variant of deliberative polling for this problem to at least be tried out in prototype. And we're purporting to raise money to try it in prototype. But the way it would work is a random sample of Internet users. Now, of course, what internationally that would mean is really daunting. But let's just say a random sample of Internet users who would create a deliberative council that could be consulted periodically and would deliberate online in a serious way. And at the end of, say, a year, they elect a certain number of board members, and then a new sample is chosen. Now, I've been talking to a lot of technical people. It is not impossible. And we are proposing, or I am proposing, I think others here are proposing, to at least try it out on a prototype basis and compare it to the self-selected model. And it will beat Ataturk, I'm certain of it, if the data is collected about both. And it would demonstrate democracy across national boundaries and borders, but not just any form of democracy, but a thoughtful democracy, because the premise of this is that we have so much democracy where people are reacted with a top-of-the-head impression of sound bites and headlines, and people don't even like to admit that they don't know, so a lot of the opinions reported in polls don't exist. You know about the famous Public Affairs Act of 1975, which a third of the public had views on, but it was fictional. And a couple years ago, the Washington Post decided to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the non-existent Public Affairs Act of 1975 by asking people what they thought of the repeal of the Public Affairs Act of 1975. And they told half the sample that President Clinton wants to repeal it, half the sample that the new Republican Congress wanted to repeal it. They got completely different results, but it didn't exist in the first place. So one aspect of pseudo-democracy is non-existent opinions, what Phil Converse, the University of Michigan, calls non-attitudes. Phantom opinions. You've got phantom opinions, unreflective voters, and unrepresentative samples, and they are those public opinion reported in that form, that is public opinion without a public, is guiding a lot of our public policy. I mean, I was just shocked to read an account that the Clinton administration, Mark Penn, is providing overnight polls that is providing some input to choices about bombing targets. Now, if that's true, that's another example of the, you know, you've got a process so how can we get a more meaningful kind of democracy? Well, the Internet actually offers, I mean, I came up with a version of how to fill the vacant public space with a prototype of an engaged public. But the Internet offers a prospect of doing it in a much more cost-effective and repeatable manner if we can make it work.
Here's one part of the story that you haven't really emphasized, but I think it connects to what Yochai was saying. So one thing about deliberative polls is that you start the process by asking people what do they think about blah, blah, and they give an answer.
Right.
And then you go into a process of deliberating about it.
Right.
And at the end of the process, you then ask them the very same question.
Right.
And you compare the results.
Right.
And there's consistently shifts.
Right.
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 Now, so one question is, what is the opportunity for using that to achieve the kind of shift in attitudes that I think both Jamie and Yochai are talking about something like the question of the value of the commons here. So what do you see as the shift? I mean, this is pejorative, but would you call it maturing of the views, or would you call it more stable views, or?
Well, the deliberative poll, we know that and have studied and have a number of, with my colleagues, a number of technical papers to demonstrate that at the end, the people are much more informed. And they come to consider judgments which have some staying power when we go back to them 9 months later. Now, I don't know what the shift would, I never know before we do it what the shift would be on any particular opinion. It's always an experiment. However, I've had tremendous faith in the results, and in many contexts where, even adversarial contexts, even some local ones where we've had regulatory contexts where stakeholder groups were at loggerheads, they were just amazed at how sensible the public was if you only gave them a chance. So I think the public would come to reasonable conclusions. Indeed, we've done this even on fairly technical issues with electric utility regulation in Texas with the Public Utility Commission. So I think the public would come to reasonable views, and at least they would be informed. Now, there are going to be some issues for which this is inappropriate. There are going to be some issues that are just technocratic issues. If you take the step, however, that you want democracy, my position is, why have pseudo-democracy? Or why have plebiscitary, top-of-the-head soundbite democracy? You might as well try to have deliberative democracy. So the Internet opens up a constructive possibility, and part of the effect, I think people may value the public dialogue more when they can see themselves in it. When they can see what a real functioning public would look like. And so that inspirational factor is, I think, the answer to the rhetorical question.
Okay. Danny, you've been closest to affecting public policy in this way. So do you want to continue? You want to say something about Jim, or you want to take something off?
I had thought about going for a kind of a eloquent connection between First Amendment values and all these patent law questions, and I actually, sitting here, came to the conclusion that there's been enough eloquence. So I'm going to try to pick a fight or incite a fight between all the lawyers here and all the hackers here, and suggest that an important part of arriving at a rhetoric that helps us all to understand what's at stake here is to end the image of computer programmers, hackers, coders as a priesthood. That for the first however many years we've been in this kind of fascination with this technology, which is indeed quite fascinating and quite extraordinary and tremendously fun and very important and complicated and all this sort of stuff. Fundamentally, too much of the world is absolutely in the dark about how any of this stuff works, and it in some sense picks up on Jamie's point about the little tip calculating card. I think that if we could end this mysticization of what goes on in computers, what goes on in communities of people who code, and think of it more as like the process of building this building and saying, well, there's a wall there and a window there and there's a clock over there, and we all understand, you know, probably most of us in this room could not build this building, but most of us understand that it's a relatively common process that goes on, and it certainly entails a whole lot of craft and a whole lot of skill, but probably not a tremendous amount of genius. And probably anyone who was presented with the idea, Jim Fishkin's deliberative polling crowd, if you told them that we wanted to patent a wall, people would say, well, that's ridiculous. And the reason that I think it's important to get past this kind of mystical notion of what the net is, what the web is that I think it really is the case that we've certainly seen it in the case of the Intermind patent on privacy-related technology. It'll come up over and over again that, in fact, people are more and more able to use patent law to control very basic things like what kind of walls you can build in cyberspace or what kind of windows you can build on the web. And I think that this is where I really take a page from your view of so many of these issues, Larry, that code, at least at many levels, is such a fundamental architectural aspect of our lives in cyberspace that we simply cannot be allow it to be controlled in the way that patent law seems to allow it to be controlled. And I believe that the way to help people understand that is for us all to get off our high horses and stop pretending that there's great mysticism going on. My view, at least, of the technical standards process for all the brilliant people who were involved, 90%, if not 99% of the value of most technical standards, which are now threatened by patents, is in fact in the consensus, not in the design, and that we have to preserve that process of enabling consensus and not allow intellectual property law to stand in the way of that. And since it's 5 o'clock, I'll stop. Thanks.
Okay. So thank the panelists, thank Charlie Nesson for this extraordinary event today. Do you want to have a last word, Charlie? Would you?
The reception at my house, and the direction is out front, and fortunately the sun is out, it's a nice walk, or it's a very short drive, and it's completely informal. It's like, you know, I don't know if we got the beer, but there's a really nice wine, I know that. There's a swimming pool that you can fall into if you want. And there should be some nice little things to nibble on. And please come and, you know, somehow sociability and community are very closely linked. So, please come.